Well, I think we'll hate to break up the conversation. I know there's a lot of interesting discussions that are underway, but we have, you've submitted over 100 questions. We've got 12 minutes now, 11 minutes and 40 seconds. That's about 7 seconds per question. We're clearly not going to be able to answer all of those, but we've looked at many of the questions that you have submitted and are going to try to pick out a few and respond to those. And perhaps one of the important things, at least what we think is important, is to be able to dispel some myths. So, Jigar, if you want to start and address a couple of these and tell us what the truth really is.
Sure. I'm going to try the ESPN approach with the 15 seconds per answer thing. I'll start with just two questions that relate to SunEdison. There's a question down here around, do you ever work with companies that are only interested in the PR aspects of solar power? We did. Today, all of our customers are signing with us not because it's green, but because it's the only way they have to lock in electricity rates for the next 25 years, because the sun's free, et cetera. So it's a hedge for them now. The other question is, how can companies overcome the initial high cost of going green? That's sort of what we do. We own and operate the solar systems as well as energy efficiency products, et cetera, for the customers, so we pay all the upfront costs, and we sign a contract for 20 years with them to buy the energy or whatever it is from us over the next 20 years. Dispelling myths. So how can the U.S. incentivize China to leapfrog dirty industrialization? I think the first thing it can do is actually leapfrog its own dirty industrialization. I would strongly caution everybody in the room. These types of statements are extraordinarily inflammatory, and I work a lot with China and India. And India especially, like, just feels like for the last 50 years, you guys created this problem, and now you're telling us we can't own a car because you guys created this problem. Like, it's a big deal, and, like, it gets to be inflammatory. The other thing is, what kinds of things can be done to make alternative energy affordable for everybody? It is affordable for everybody now. I mean, the thing with alternative energy is, again, it's a paradigm shift, right? So it leads to another one of the questions about what governments can do, is that the government has to recognize that building a coal power plant in the middle of nowhere that creates economic justice issues, and then building a $1.8 billion transmission line to get the power from there to the city of choice is way more expensive than just putting solar on all of the houses in the Ninth Ward, right? I mean, it's like, so that's just a paradigm shift to make it more affordable. And then the last question that I think was addressed to me was, well, that I can answer, is how can community colleges and high schools contribute to the creation of green collar jobs? So what SunEdison's doing now is we're partnering with community colleges around the country because of the 455,000 job years I was talking about, where we work with people to say, you know, if you put the solar technicians course in or whatever else, we'll guarantee that we'll hire 20% of the people that graduate from that course. So there's a lot of things that we can do to promote green collar jobs, and I'd love for you guys to all help with getting your local technical vocational schools or community colleges involved.
Great. Peggy, lots of questions about China. I think Jigar pointed out an important issue here. This is not China's problem. It's our problem. It's not a problem that it's a problem that we have created, but lots of questions about China here.
Well, you know, it's we all win or we all lose. It's not U.S. or China or U.S. and India. So I thought I'd address several of the questions by talking a little bit about the programs that we're working on in China and where we're having students actively involved this summer. So we've chosen all of our programs to be near term within 3 years and then high impact. And what we typically do is try to work with channels of key decision makers. So one of the programs is a mayoral training course with a mayoral training center in Beijing. This is a mandatory course for all mayors in China, and again, there's at least 650 of these people, and then deputy mayors. All of them are trying to learn how to be mayors, but also trying to green themselves and reach the 11th five-year plan targets. So what we're doing is we're bringing together best practices from city-level best practices to them, and then match them with vendors of products and services that can help them implement locally. This requires a lot of research, a lot of translation, stuff that students are going to help us with this summer. Something on the fun side, Shanghai Media Group has asked us to do 6 documentaries for them. This is the equivalent of China's An Inconvenient Truth, which never really took off there. So this is an opportunity to do a lot of research, a lot of fun, movie development. What are the human interest stories? What are the environmental stories? We have a smart grid program where we're trying to drive a national interest to plan smart grid. So basically invest in a better grid early on. Jigar talked about transmission. Two-thirds of all power is lost between the time that you create it to the time that you use it to cool your beer in the fridge. Two-thirds of that. Okay. So being able to do research on what are the best practices worldwide on smart grid and then bring them to the government leaders that we're working with in China and educate them about what the key early decisions are that they can make now so as not to preempt the option for a smart grid later is really, really impactful. We have a Hollywood producer who's interested in doing We Are the World for Green at the Olympics. He's raising money for that. Now, if he is successful, Juice will be the sole beneficiary of this, and we're going to have to work with celebrities and get them on board and, you know, make sure that the music is good and, you know, all that type of stuff. So there's a lot of opportunities for students using sort of basic research skills and communication skills, as I said before, to help create access to knowledge and access to products and services for these Chinese decision makers.
Great. Nikki, big ideas. How do we talked a lot about energy. How do we harness the energy in this room?
Harnessing the energy in this room. So students. I saw a question on there about students. I'm still a student. I'm getting a master's degree in African American Studies. And the Energy Action Coalition actually has a phone call talking about what can students do about green collar jobs. Because the idea sounds brilliant. But a lot of college students come to me and say, but I'm in college to get a white-collar job. I want to be able to support my family. I don't want to come in entry level. That's why I'm getting a degree. So all these things are flying around, right? But one major thing about students over the years, especially since the 60s, is that when the government has been a little slow, if the Senate's not quite with us yet when it comes to passing certain policies or the House and the Senate disagreeing, and we have exactly 5 years before enough gas and smoke and pollution gets into the air to where we'll all have asthma, you can get 6,000 students to come to D.C. and say, hey, can you do something about this? And that is at the that's the very bottom vision of what students can do. We have the extraordinary ability to converge en masse, to push political agendas, to make all kinds of different generations listen to what's most important. So I would encourage all of you to really keep up with what's coming out in academia, what's coming out in research, what's coming out in economics and politics, so that when something needs to happen and the government's or whatever systems are in place are moving a little slow, you can converge and you can make things happen.
Great, great. So Christine, how do we pay for all this?
Well, I want to tackle the question about what types of financing mechanisms are needed and talk, just use the work that I've been doing for the past 15 years as an example. IANCO is a nonprofit organization, but we're an investment company. We invest in these clean energy businesses, and we're also doing that capacity building, that business training. That requires a blending of public and private capital, and it really fosters the need for public-private partnerships between government agencies, the World Bank, the bilateral organizations, and local partners, local NGO partners, and local businesses. I think one of the things that's interesting as you explore this space is there really is a whole new avenue of hybrid business models out there. It's really the third way of accomplishing some significant development and energy objectives and climate change objectives in the developing world. And the hybrid model is a new way of blending public and private capital to achieve things like the triple bottom line or a double bottom line if you're just really focusing on the job generation and the quality of life improvements. So the financing mechanisms are some creativity. It's really looking at ways that you can blend them to provide market rate returns but have those social and environmental impacts as well.
Great. PJ, we haven't answered all 100 questions, but we tried to address some of the important ones. PJ is going to try to summarize what you've been doing for the past, 30 minutes while we were out of the room.
Yeah, and again, thanks to the theme team who's been working incredibly hard to do all this for you. I'm going to give Bud a copy of these as well so he can take a look. But A lot of themes and a lot of really amazing ideas as well. In terms of themes that came out, a lot of you thought that campuses ought to sign the president's climate commitment to drive their own emissions reduction.
How many, raise your hand if your university signed the climate commitment. Maybe we should, well, I was going to say maybe we should do it the other way, but I don't want to embarrass anybody.
And if you don't know, you can go to presidentsclimatecommitment.org and find out. And also get advice about how best to create a campaign on your campus. Sir? There you go. Schools can generate interdisciplinary programs that link economic development to sustainability programs. Universities ought to offer more financial incentives for students to live more sustainably. A lot of you thought that it's important to find creative ways to finance the creation of green universities that take the lead on these issues. That universities ought to involve communities in their sustainability projects. Creating incentives to design specifically for local contexts that integrate cultural considerations. Carpools don't mean much to non-commuter schools. It's one of the comments that was made. In terms of GEMS and specific ideas that you all had to make a difference, someone suggested that fraternities and sororities ought to take the leadership role in sharing and showing students how to go green. Combining education on energy efficiency in low-income communities with low-interest loans to buy Energy Star products. Students ought to run for political office to create policy change. Universities can implement live feed energy meters at high-use locations like dorms and publicize the results in real time. And there's a great commitment by one of you on that that I think we're going to talk about a little bit later. At Temple, one month of savings of energy was given back to students on campus, so creating incentives there for people to get engaged. Tufts brought faculty together to break down silos across different issue areas and incorporate sustainability in 175 of its courses. And I believe that's what we've got in terms of the big themes. But we're also going to collate a lot of these and I think publish them on the CGI website as well. So thank you for the great, rich conversation.
Hang on 1 second. Well, we talked a little bit about myths. And I think the themes that you've identified are terrific. And we'll try to address those. But before we do that, I think I want to try to dispel one myth. And that is that there's a belief that going green somehow has costs associated with it. But when you really think about it, it's not costs, it's opportunities. I'll use my own university, for example. We have, at the University of Colorado at Boulder, have a bus pass program that we joined or developed with the city. Last year had over 3 million rides on the bus, where students get a free bus pass that takes them anywhere in Boulder, from Boulder to Denver to the airport. That saves us an enormous amount of money as a university in terms of parking. One of the big surprises in life, I think, is how expensive it is to make a parking lot and maintain that parking lot. But things like bus passes that save parking spaces that at the same time are very eco-friendly. We've introduced initiatives that have reduced the potable water on the campus by 113 million gallons, or 30% per square foot over the past 4 years. Tremendous savings there. Recycling saves over 18,000 trees a year, 1.6 million BTUs of energy, and 8 million gallons of water, and over 16,000 tons of carbon each year saved through these activities that the students have actually undertaken and pressed for. The themes, comments on the themes, Jigar.
We didn't talk a lot about transportation here in this panel, and I want just everyone to know that, I mean, asthma rates within 1 mile of a highway in this country are twice as high as the national average. During the Atlanta Olympics, we saved more money because all the highways were basically shut down during the Atlanta Olympics. They had 75% less people going to emergency rooms for asthma-related attacks. So when we talk about being green and these kind of things actually saving money, they actually save real money. They're not just sort of pie in the sky, like not auditable or not tangible savings.
I just wanted to refer everybody to a book called Collapse by Jared David, the author of Guns, Germs, and Steel. If you haven't, Hey, jet lag. if you haven't read it yet, please do.
Okay, that's a great note. I actually had an African-American studies professor who had us read Guns, Germs, and Steel and had us compare that to the African-American experience. It was very interesting, I'll tell you that. Something that I saw when looking at the themes was different universities doing different things. You know, I saw a reference to Tufts and I saw a reference to another university. And I think that's a really good thing to think about when it comes to what students can do as well, because this country looks very different if you travel from one end of it to another. You'll see a bunch of different people, you'll hear a bunch of different accents, you'll see a bunch of different cities. Universities follow the same pattern. There are historically black colleges and universities. There's public, there's private, there's community college. All the different presidents' commitments were, they were, students went about getting the different presidents' commitments in a bunch of different ways. And I think looking at the different types of activisms that go on all the different campuses are a perfect example of how something can look different and yet the same. And part of sustainability is looking at what the ecosystem of the area is and coming from within to establish something unique to that ecosystem that works instead of laying a general pattern over something when all of the areas look very different. And that can apply to people as well. And so when looking at something that you can do, take encouragement from the fact that we all have a lot of different things to learn from, but also understand that even universities and colleges are still very fragmented in a lot of different ways, and we do need to be working together a little more.
Closing comments, Christine.
Okay. The closing comment I'd like to have, really building on what Nikki said, is when you think about how to enter this space, recall that you can get into this space from the environment side and deal exclusively on green energy and climate change. You can come in through the development side and think about how climate change is going to impact the billions of people out there who are not going to be able to adapt and mitigate to rising sea waters and hotter temperatures and droughts. Or you can get in it through the finance side and really look at what does it mean to create business opportunities in this space, whether it's through green tech or clean tech. But the reality is, as a professional interested in this space, you really have to understand all three sides. You have to be able to think about development, think about finance, and think about environment. And that truly is what is going to enable you all as the next generation to create a sustainable future.
And Peggy.
Sorry, one last comment. I think awareness is still something that you can easily help with. So in China, one of our partners brought in something called the Clean Air Challenge. It's a curriculum for middle school and high school students. And they translated it into Chinese. And when they did, they said, you know, you have to add a sulfur dioxide component because China is the largest emitter of sulfur dioxide. So fine, they did that. And then they said, you know, we don't actually have an ozone problem, so you can take away the ozone whole chapter there. And they're shocked. So they brought these ozone testing strips, which then immediately turned black. And the teachers were like, wow, how come nobody told us there's an ozone problem? This is like a really basic level of awareness that doesn't exist in China. The other day, a guy named Taylor Francis emailed me and then gave me a call yesterday. This is at 14, he's 15 now. He was the youngest trained person to trained personally by Al Gore to give the Inconvenient Truth spiel. And he's coming to China for a week, and he's going to be talking to schools and government officials and corporations. So even at 15, and I know you guys are much older than that, you know, he's making a huge wave. So you guys can do a lot just by spreading the word.
Great. Well, listen, this is a special group. I know all of you made commitments, applied, and were selected to come here. What we'd like to do at this particular point in time is just recognize a couple of the commitments that have been made by individuals. And I'd like to ask these folks to please come up, and we'll recognize you. The first is Gary Hsu. Gary is... Come on up here, Gary. Gary's a graduate student at MIT, and he's developed a program for bicycles on the MIT campus. And it's, what's it called, Gary?
Tech bikes.
You want to say something about it? 1 minute?
Sure. This kind of stemmed out of a course project where we studied bicycle sharing systems, kind of like car sharing, where you have stations and you are a member and you pick up a bike and you can use it to go around campus and then drop it off. And hopefully it encourages more people to get around campus using bicycles than walking or taking a shuttle or driving.
Great. Great. Congratulations. How many of you have campuses, or how many of your campuses have a program like that that shares bicycles? You might want to touch base with Gary and give him some suggestions and some thoughts about it. Second commitment that I'd like to recognize is Jennifer Bauer from William Patterson University. Jennifer? Congratulations. Jennifer has developed a way to cut down on the carbon emissions and the carbon footprint at William Patterson University by lobbying for it to become a central hub for the New Jersey Transit and introducing a carpooling program. Jennifer, you want to say a few words?
Since New Jersey is one of the most densely populated states, it's become readily apparent that a lot of students are choosing to commute to schools. Just at William Patterson, we have over 50% of our student population commuting from their regular home every day. And a lot of them live in the same areas. And we have like so many cars. They're circling the parking lots for 15 minutes looking for a parking spot because we don't have the facilities or the ability to continue accepting so many cars, and so many people are choosing that lifestyle. We have a great university program that's started only about a year ago when I was a freshman. And we started competing to become the central hub for New Jersey Transit, which is our primary public transportation system. And I'm very pleased to announce that we found out just last month while I was doing the application that we've won that competition. So. Part of this commitment is going to be raising awareness about this new achievement, adding two additional lines to reach commuter students and bring them to campus every day, and doing at least two publicity awareness campaigns every semester, incorporating different events in our new student center. So I hope it will be successful.
Congratulations. And the third commitment we'd like to recognize is President Dan Fogel from the University of Vermont. President Fogel. President Fogel has developed a plan for an interdisciplinary center to focus graduate and undergraduate research and education on issues, green issues, and to try to help the University of Vermont, which may be one of the few places on Earth that's greener than Boulder, Colorado.
Well, thank you, Bud. We are working very hard to break down the silos and tap all of the creative energy of our professional staff, our students, and our faculty to not only conduct research and education, but also to apply integrated solutions that require multidisciplinary understandings of the challenges we've been discussing here today. So we're very excited about the work we're doing and about this meeting.
Congratulations. Well, I think that brings us to the close of the panel. I want to thank all the panelists. I want to thank all of you for participating. We've talked and often talk about the challenges that these issues present to us. And I hope that what we've been able to do is to move the discussion a little bit away from the challenges and towards the opportunities that the new industries that will be created through your efforts and your ideas and your innovative and creative approaches to solving these problems, but to identify what those opportunities are and pursue those. So with that, I think we're going to get instructions on what happens next from on high. Thank you very
Ladies
much for coming.
Ladies and gentlemen, the working session is now concluded. Your meetups will begin at 12:30 p.m. Box lunches are available outside this room, so please get your lunch and then find your meetup room in one of the following session rooms. The West Region will meet in this area in the faculty dining room. The Northwest Region will meet in Kendall Cram Hall, located next door to us on this level. The South Region will meet in the ballroom, also located on this floor, down the hall and around the corner. The Midwest region will meet in the Ratskeller, which is located in the basement, and the international region will meet on the Rosenberg mezzanine, located towards the lobby in between the first and second floors. Please proceed to your meetup sessions now.